from chapter 2, verses 8 to 14, we go through the second section. This sign seminar produces the following commentary on the next section. The division becomes apparent that we have seen a removal of the Shulamite from her first position, which was centered in her own environment, and her work was transferred by force by her own brothers. Right? So you've got the church in the first phase is in Jerusalem. And it was surrounded by the daughters of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem tried to stamp out the church. And it was because of the Jews that the church had to be transferred. They fled the Pella for the destruction of the temple, and they then set up the Ephesian era improper through the apostles, centered on Ephesus. So we go on here. The first scene concluded with the failure of the king and his court ladies to persuade the peasant girl to be disloyal to her lover. They didn't succeed. Judah did not stop the church. This section is devoted to an account of how one spring morning the shepherd came and invited her to join him in the field. To prevent this meeting, her brothers transferred her work to the vineyards from which she had been taken by force to the royal court. She finds consolation in the certainty that a lover would seek her. Now his approach is traced until he reaches the wall of the building in which she is confined. Peering through the attic window, he fails to see her and pleads for the sound of her voice. In reply, she informs him that she has sent away the court ladies who guard her to hunt foxes that destroy the vineyards. And this is according to Rav Malbim. These, once again, like the rest, all the words of the song have significance. The brothers appear to represent the nation not sympathetic to the beloved. This could only be Judah. The church is then persecuted under the circumstances we see in the text. This would accord with what we understand of the Smyrna era. The court ladies hunt foxes that destroy the vineyards. The ruse is to hunt false shepherds. The foxes are also found in the story of Samson, where there are 300 tied in pairs. These symbols are explained in Samson and the Judges, and you also see what happens in Gideon and the forces of the last days, or Gideon's force in the last days. In the Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 8 and 14, says, "The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills." The text uses the word kol, literally voice, in the sense of hark. And that's, look, you can compare that to Genesis 4, 10, Isaiah 43, 3. The sense here is implied that it means here with the ears, is applied to the meaning hark, meaning listen to the voice of a shepherd. And the elect hear the voice of the shepherd, as we know from John 10:25-30. John 10:25-30 says, "Jesus answered them, I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness to me. But you do not believe because you do not belong to my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, and no one shall snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and the Father are one." That's a pretty powerful text. It's a powerful concept. And that's the thing that keeps the church free and pure from idolatry and free and pure from false doctrines. Because when you hear these false doctrines, you know that they are not the voice of our Master. They are not the voice of the shepherd. And you simply are taken away from these false teachers. Now there are some serious states concerning the text. The author depicts how the Shulamite hears the footsteps of her beloved, although he is still far away. She nevertheless discerns that he is coming. He is leaping upon the mountains from mountain to mountain, and then upon the hills below. He is hastening over the hills with the speed of a swift-footed gazelle, according to Melvin. Now she must be alluding to her shepherd, since the language would not be used of a king, according to the Sonsina. So the language here, used in the Hebrew, is not the language of a king. They are talking about the priest Messiah. Because when Christ came in the first instance, he came as the priest Messiah of Aaron. He was not the king Messiah of Israel. And that is why some of his disciples could not stand. That is why Judas fell away. That is why many fell away when he did not take up the sword as a ruling monarch. This language is of a shepherd. He is a shepherd of the sheep until the end of the era of the churches. And at the end of the era of the church, as he comes again as the King Messiah in power and glory. That same symbolism is mirrored in the Day of Atonement, when the priest Messiah is dressed in linen, makes atonement, and then you have the separation of the goats, and then he is re-attired in the apparel of the King Messiah. So there are two priests involved. The high priest is in two forms of dress on the Day of Atonement, one as priest Messiah and the other as King Messiah, as high priest. Right? Ruling high priest and the atoning priest. And they're two different forms of dress. One is in clear white linen with no royal apparel. The other is in the total royal apparel of the ruling high priest. Now that is the division between Christ in the first instance and Christ in the second instance. And the language is used of a shepherd for the period in the interim. Now this text refers also to Psalm 114 verses 4 to 6. Now Psalm 114 verses 4 to 6 says, "The mountains skip like rams, the hills skip like lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O hills, like lambs?" So we've sung that many, many times. Many times. It is of Messiah and the messianic advent. The hills are literally being shaken at the coming of the Messiah. So this beloved that's skipping over the hills, I don't know too many shepherds that can jump over hills. We are talking about the one true shepherd, Messiah. So the reversal is used in this text. Messiah makes the hills themselves skip. Right? So they use this parallelism, is then extended into reversals. Messiah then skips the hills, and in the Psalms the hills themselves are skipping. And Psalm 29:6 says he makes Lebanon to skip like a calf and Syrian like a young wild ox. Thus we deal with a period up to his return while he is yet distant. He is not yet returned as King Messiah. He comes first as priest Messiah or the Messiah of Aaron and became high priest of the order of Melchizedek from Psalm 110:4. Now at the time of Christ, the Dead Sea Scrolls was quite clear. All of Judah expected a Messiah of two advents. They expected a Messiah of Aaron, they expected a Messiah of Israel. And in the Damascus Rule 7 of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and an unpublished statement in Cave 4, they're quite clear that the Messiah of Aaron and the Messiah of Israel are the one Messiah. So you've got one Messiah with two advents. The Jews understood that at the time of Christ. Absolutely, we've dug the scrolls up, we know exactly what they meant. We know that that was the understanding. And the Pharisees still killed Jesus Christ, even though they knew that there had to be two Messiahs and two advents. But some of them actually knew they had to kill him in order to fulfill the prophecies. Now in verse 9 it says, "My beloved is like a gazelle, or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our walls, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice." This is very interesting in the words, the text, the way it's translated and what it means. The Socino notes to this text, "It has already come so close that he stands behind our wall. Now he has come still closer, for he peered through the lattice." He actually thrust his head through the lattice. The word metzitz means blossoms, denoting something protruding, according to Rav Ralbin. It is likewise possible that the word for peered signifies to sparkle, and perhaps suggested that she thinks of a rescuer as so close that she can see the ardent gleam in his eyes. That's according to Rashi, and looking at Psalm 132:18. Now that's a text in the Sansina. The beloved places his head as head of the elect so that it protrudes through the barriers of the earthly system. He sparkles as the new morning star designate. Now verse 10 says, "My beloved speaks and says to me, Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away." This text is understood that a lover raised his voice and called her to join him, according to Malbim and Mitzvah David. Verse 11 says, "For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone." The word sithav occurs only here. The only place in the Bible it's used. The word sithav is translated as winter and has the meaning of winter, but it doesn't mean that. Based on the Targum, Genesis 8:22, it is synonymous with choref, meaning winter. So you need to translate sithav here, you need to refer to the Tractate Targum on Genesis 8:22. So according to many commentators, this is the second half of Kislev, the Tibeth, and the first half of Shibat, ending usually in February. And the Strong's Hebrew Dictionary 5638 shows this word to stem from an unused root meaning to hide, and hence it means a season of hiding. And this is synonymous with winter. So they use it, the word is synonymous with winter, but it means the season of hiding. And that is what the church is doing at this time. This is the persecutions of the Smyrna era. This is the time that they went into tribulation. Is the hiding attendant upon the persecution of Smyrna during the persecution referred to at Revelation 2:10. We look at Revelation 2 verses 9 to 10. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. These people were persecuted 10 days. Now, they were persecuted 10 days. Not in the West, they weren't. They were persecuted 10 days in the East. Diocletian's persecution was 10 years long in the Eastern churches, but it was only 3 years long in the Western churches. That's why there's been some confusion. It's, oh, this prophecy wasn't kept, because a lot of them were looking at Diocletian's persecution in West Europe. They were saying it was only 3 years, but it was 10 years in the East. And the East were the ones in Smyrna, when the church was based on Smyrna, that they were persecuted more, and they took the brunt of the persecution. And the persecution then ceased for a time, but it then occurred over many years under its successor. So the empire, the persecution of the empire, was not all that long or great. In fact, Gibbon says that during the entire period of the Roman Empire, there were only 1,500 people put to death. Right? Only 1,500 Christians were martyred during the entire period of the Roman Empire. And most of those were put to death for striking magistrates. In other words, they took them into court, and they literally got up and jobbed the magistrates so they'd be put to death, so they could get into the first resurrection. And that is not the way to get into the first resurrection. It wasn't the Roman Empire that persecuted the church overly much. It was 10 years under Diocletian. The persecution of the church came under the successor of the Roman Empire, which was the Holy Roman Empire. They killed hundreds of thousands. It was actually the Christian church that persecuted the true Church of God. The mainstream Christian church were the persecutors of the Church of God. Nobody else. The Roman Empire left us alone by and large. Now verse 12 says, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. This verse is misunderstood. The flowers appearing are taken to be the spring flowers in Palestine, according to Akedat Yitzchak. The time of singing is, however, rendered in the Septuagint, and also by Rashbam, as the time for pruning the vines. And then compare Leviticus 25:3 with that. This is the time of pruning the vines. We're then going into now the tribulation and the pruning the vines and tearing out the weakness in the church. This marked the councils of Nicaea, Constantinople, and Chalcedon, and the vines were pruned. Others maintain that Zania is the name of a migratory bird that utters song on its return to spring, according to Daf Mikra. The Midrash refers to the verse to Moses and Aaron, the flowers, who coming to Pharaoh resulted in Israel singing, according to Israel singing Az Yashir from Exodus 15, at the Red Sea after the winter of oppression in Egypt, according to the Son Singer. Now the voice of the turtle dove is not a singing bird, but a bird of passage, as you'll see from comparing it to Jeremiah 8:7. Its voice announces the coming of spring, as Rav Malbim says. The pruning of the vines is the understanding of the persecution and the trial of the elect. The analogy to Moses and Aaron and to Israel in Egypt and at the Red Sea is exactly that of the church in the wilderness of the 40 Jubilees on a year for a Jubilee basis. Israel was 40 years in the wilderness, the church was 40 Jubilees in the wilderness. Israel was judged 40 years after 3 years mission of Messiah, the Gentile nations were given 40 Jubilees, and then the world is torn down, the world systems are torn down. Now verse 13 says, the fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Now, the fig tree putteth forth has a literal sense of the verb sweetens with spice, which is also used for the act of embalming the spices, according to the Sonsino. This may also refer to the pollen, which resembles the spices sprinkled on the dead in the process of embalming, according to Ibn Ezra. The meaning thus is a connection with the spices of affliction. The symbolism was used of Messiah at and before his burial. Myrrh is also a basis for the name of Mordecai, which has also Messianic symbolism in the story of Esther, as we've noted before. The text relating to green figs is important. Now, green figs, which is Hebrew pagiha, ripe figs are called te'enim, and those that ripen early, bikura. Figs ripen at various times, usually from August onwards. Some remain unripe on the tree until the following spring. The green figs are slightly darker in colour, and the verb hanat, which is related to the reddish-brown wheat, chita, suggests the translation, the fig tree maketh red ripe her winter figs, according to the Sonsino. Thus the meaning is that those ripened under the season of hiding are red ripe, or likened also to the wheat harvest, which is that of the elect. The vines in blossom is also significant. The vines in blossom is noted for their sweet fragrance. Samada is a word of unknown origin and occurring only here. So this word again occurs only in the Song of Songs. Is interpreted by the rabbis as tender grapes when they first appear. A few weeks later they become bosorim, and when fully ripe are called anabim. When the blossoms fall away and the grapes are visible, that is the stage of samada, according to Rav Rashi. We are thus dealing with the first fruit stage of the vine. This is the early stage of the calling of the elect. In verse 14 says, O my dove, in the cleft of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face and let me hear your voice. For your voice is sweet and your face is comely. Now, Kimchi renders the text on top of the rocks. And the dove in the cleft of the rocks represents a dove remaining in its nesting place when hiding. The shepherd lover, impatient at her delay to join him, urges her to leave her hiding place, according to Malbim. Now, the church went into hiding during the persecution and could not accomplish its task. The shepherd calls it to action. The Song of Songs at 2:15-17 says, catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, turn my beloved like a gazelle, be like a gazelle or a young stag upon rugged mountains. The text is take us the foxes or catch us the foxes, where she explains to her lover how she rid herself of the daughters of Jerusalem, who kept a close watch over her. She urged them to hunt the foxes who were destroying the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom, according to Melbourne. Now the daughters of Jerusalem inhibited the actions of the church, the actions of Judah, even though it was hardened and thus denied conversion, was able to withstand the effects of the attacks on the faith made by Gnostic elements, and thus preserve intact the physical understanding of scriptures ready for the restoration. In this manner the church was able to free itself from the daughters of Jerusalem also. But the little foxes that destroyed the vineyards ultimately ended up in the councils, of creating the councils of Nicaea, Constantinople, and Chalcedon. And the false priesthood, these foxes, these false priests and prophets, destroyed the faith and created what's now called the mainstream Christian church. And those people do not enter the first resurrection. They destroyed the vineyards of God. Now, Sonsino comments on the term the little foxes is telling. The little foxes. Perhaps she's referring to a danger at court. Comparing herself to a vineyard, she calls upon him to save her from the foxes who seek to destroy her true happiness. This may be an allusion to the story of Samson, who released foxes in the vineyard to avenge himself against those who had destroyed his marriage, according to Rav Malbim. So Malbim understands that it does relate back to Samson. Now, if you look back at when we dealt with Samson and the Judges, this whole structure is of Christ operating in the Holy Spirit with Samson to establish the forward prophecies on the bringing down of the Gentile nations. These 300 foxes were sent forward two by two into the nations of the Gentiles by Jesus Christ. These are the 300 lights under bushels that are smashed at the same time so that the gospel of the kingdom of God is brought to the Gentiles and the nations are given the understanding. So Malbim understood that. And as we said, Samson used the 300 foxes to set alight the fields of the Philistines. It is a physical representation of the spiritual intervention of Messiah. It refers to the development of the Holy Spirit in the individual as it occurs with Samson. Messiah, as the angel of Jehovah, uses Samson to deal with the Gentile system, and also, as I said, these foxes relate also to the Gideon's force in the last days and the lamps of Gideon. So the foxes that destroy the vineyards are the shepherds who are to be removed from the flock. The passages in Ezekiel 34, Malachi and others show this to be the power of the rabbinical teachers. The structure had to be removed from its influence on the elect. The term in blossom means that it is easily destroyed, according to Masudah David. Therefore the protection had to be extended to ensure the elect were not destroyed before they could develop. So the comment, "my beloved is mine," in verse 16, is held to mean that the woman turns to the women, that is the daughters of Jerusalem, and she makes this passionate confession as though to imply, "my brothers succeeded in separating us, but we are forever united in our love," according to Masudah David. So the Jews separated us from Messiah and put us in the wilderness, but we are still united to Messiah as the church. So of course the brothers of Judah did succeed in doing that. And we will be united at the marriage supper of the Lamb. Judah will also be converted and take its place when it realizes the full significance of the Messianic scriptures to which it has been blinded. Now, it's got a hardness of heart that's come over Judah, but that hardness is going to be taken away. In the last days, Judah is going to be converted, and Judah is going to be restored first. Now, the term in verse 17, "until the day breathe," is literally "until the day blow." That is, the evening breeze rises. Masudah David explains, "until the sun blow away from the earth." This is held by the rabbis to be the end of the day. However, the meaning can also be "the day dawns," as mentioned by Peter in 2 Peter 1:19. 2 Peter 1:19 says, "And we have the prophetic word made more sure. You will do well to pay attention to this, as to a lamp shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts." Messiah is the new morning star. The reference to the shadows fleeing can also be to the light removing all darkness and all shadow. The meaning is taken to extend until sunset as being when the shadows flee away. The separation is to be only until sunset, when she will expect him, according to the Masudah David. Thus the rabbis did understand that the process was that there was a separation which entailed at the end a reconciliation. And this is the reconciliation of Christ and the church at the marriage supper. Now the term "upon rugged mountains" is rendered by the Sonsino as "upon the mountains of spices." And this translation follows Gratz's translation. The final word "bada" means division or separation, and may refer to the intervening mountains which the shepherd had to cross in order to reach her. The word "division" is aptly used of mountains that appear to be cleft. Other explanations propose are that it is a proper noun, the mountains of Bada, according to Masudah David. The mountains of division or separation are referred to in the various texts describing Messiah returning to the church and Israel. The mountains in the end prove to be the refuge of the survivors of the wrath of God. Division is also evident in the church through error. The broken staff of union is a division that resulted in the separation of Israel and Judah. Now when we go into chapter 3 of the Song of Songs, we then deal with the next sequence. Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 1 to 3 says, "Upon my bed by night I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him but found him not. I called him but he gave no answer." Now the Sonsino notes of the text, it says, "Many days later, the maiden, imprisoned in Solomon's chambers, remembers her lover and his love while lying in bed at night. She rises from her bed and goes out to seek him in the city. She does not find him until she leaves the city and goes out into the wilderness. She joins her beloved until she is pursued by the daughters of Jerusalem. Nevertheless, she continues her union with him, and he speaks to her affectionately." This episode relates how she left Solomon's bed and how the daughters of Jerusalem did not separate them afterwards. And this goes on until verse 2, according to Malbim. "And as I sought him," is repeated to connote that she sought him repeatedly. a pause here for a digression. This whole concept of the daughters of Jerusalem and Solomon's bed, Solomon's litter, as you'll see later, and the concept of the beloved and the Shulamite relate to the capacity to separate the church from Judah and the traditions of the Pharisees. The daughters of Jerusalem and Solomon's litter represent the structure, the false system that we've incorporated into the Judaic faith, particularly from the Babylonian captivity. And with the Babylonian and the Jerusalem tractate Talmuds, there was an oral law which became injected into the understanding of the Bible. Consequently, the church had to free itself of this dependence upon the Talmud, upon the oral traditions, in order to understand the purity of the biblical truth and to become united or joined to Messiah. Now that really is the understanding of the struggle that's going on in the Song of Songs. And I've tried to then develop this Song of Songs using what might be understood by the superimposition of the eras of the churches and the messages in Revelation over the period of the church over the 2,000 years. That is, to me, is an important understanding. To throw away the concept of the eras tells you that there are a whole sequence of messages lost, because Christ gave, in the start of Revelation, gave to the church those messages split up over the period to show what the development sequence of the problems would be over the church. Now, whilst each church era may have elements of the seven churches within it, the concept of the eras developing cannot be eliminated, and they aptly and accurately describe the activities that occurred in the church over the period. So that the era system is a useful tool in understanding the history of the church. And that's why it is rejected by most of the churches who do not wish to fit within the constraints of the Bible. For instance, none of the Trinitarian churches of Catholic persuasion, or the three organisations, accept the church eras, because if they did, they would stand condemned by it, so they have to throw it out. And the 20th century Protestant structure also wants to throw it out because they've come under the greatest condemnation by it. So I think, bearing in mind those concepts, we then deal with the concept of the elect being drawn out. So the elect among Israel are constantly being called and are in battle with the reactionary elements of Judaism. Now, this will only cease on the conversion of Judah as a whole. Now, this will occur in the last days because of this constant love affair of the nation with Messiah, in spite of the rabbinical resistance to the messianic restructuring of the priesthood and the elect. Now, Zechariah 9:9 shows how Messiah came to the daughters of Jerusalem and they did not receive him. We go on to verse 2. It says, "I will rise now and go about into the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not." Now, the Messiah was not to be found within the structure of Jerusalem and the temple, or in the later rabbinical systems. Now, the Messiah condemned the rabbinical and Pharisaical systems, where he said that you, by your traditions, affect the laws of God, the truth of God. So he condemned the Talmudic traditions as rendering of no account the laws of God. Now, it was only in the wilderness could this union occur that is free of the constraints, so that we're looking at the Song of Songs representing the taking of the church, the elect, out of the constraints, putting them in the wilderness so their true love mates with Jesus Christ, their true relationship, their first love, could be established. Now, verse 3 says, "The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves?" Looking in the city, because the beloved is not to be found there. he was put to death by them, by the Jerusalem authorities. Now the watchmen are the watchmen of Ezekiel, and the scribes and executioners of Ezekiel 8:1 to 9:11. I read that text to get a feel for what is happening with the watchmen. And the text then goes on to the finding of the loved one. The rabbinical authorities hold that the watchman did not answer her, according to Mitzvah David. In the Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 4 to 5, it says, "It was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up, nor awaken love, till he please." Right? Now this is a very important concept. It relates to the calling of the elect. It relates to the stirring up of the first love of the Ephesian system until it is your appointed time through God. So the immediate follow-on from the watchman to the beloved shows a nexus of one aspect to the other. If they answered her, she neglects to state the answer. There is an abruptness in the style here in the text. The bringing of the beloved into the mother's house is a permanent place and not skipping over the mountains that separate them, according to Malbim. Now the permanent place is a reference to the house of the mother, which is Jerusalem and Zion, as the capital of Israel and the centre of the millennial system. The elect are going to bring the beloved into Zion. That is, when the Messiah comes, he will join the bride in her house. The Messiah is going to come to the house of the elect, which is Jerusalem and Zion. "And the chamber of her that conceived me is an example of the parallelism that characterized Hebrew poetry. However, chamber of her that conceived the church is the temple, so that the mother's house for the nation is the same as the chambers of the church." Now, the text in verse 5 is held by Malbim to relate to the fact that the daughters of Jerusalem pursue her, and she adjures them not to alienate the love that the beloved has for her, as above verse 2. Now this relates to the aspects of conversion. The adjuration is that the conversion of the daughters of Jerusalem does not take place before they are ready to be called by God. In other words, until it pleases God. Judah was not to be called and converted until the times of the Gentiles were completed. Now this period lasted 7 time frames, from the period of 605 to 525 BC and ended in 1914 to 1994-95. They could not understand, and it was given to them in parables, so that they would not turn and be saved before they were ready to come into judgment. So there's only individuals who were called out of Judah. Only individuals. But in the end, the tribe will be converted. The text then goes on to the next phrase of the story, which relates to the power of Israel. Now in the Song of Solomon, chapter 3, verses 6 to 11, it says, "Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, and with all powders of the merchant?" And the Sonsino makes this telling comment. "When the maiden returns from the wilderness, everyone wonders how she fled from Solomon's bed at night. How did it happen that the mighty men surrounding it did not detain her? This is the question. Who is this that cometh up out of the wilderness? Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. 80 mighty men are about it." Now the answer is, every man hath his sword upon his thigh because of dread of the night. The dread of the night fell upon them until they are unable to draw their swords, as Malbim has it in the Sonsino. This comment shows the condition of Judah and the mighty men of Israel at this period. The question on Judah's lips here is, how did the church escape from the environs of Judah and Jerusalem? Firstly, Judah tried to detain the church and destroy it. In the latter days, Judah comes to this realization and is converted from that realization and from the adversity in which it finds itself. Now we see this developing from this period in history. And the whole process of looking and examining itself, Judah examining itself, started from the Holocaust. And the conversion of Judah commenced with the harvest from the Holocaust. Now verse 7 says, "Behold at his bed, which is Solomon's, 80 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man had a sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. Now King Solomon made himself a chariot of the wood of Lebanon. He made the pillars thereof of silver, and the bottom thereof of gold, the covering of it of purple, the midst thereof being paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem." So it's a symbolic thing. Go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon, with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him, in the day of his espousals, and in the day of the gladness of his heart. And that's from the King James Version. Now the fear in the night is because of the destruction surrounding the nation. The sword are on their thighs, as were the bows in the hands of the men who built the walls of Jerusalem under Nehemiah, as we see in Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 10 to 20. I won't go through reading it, but basically, Nehemiah, that they were under threat, so they built the temple, they built the walls around the temple, I should say, the temple was already constructed. They built the walls around the temple with their bows in their hands and their weapons on their thighs. And it was necessary that that be done because they were under adversity. That was done in order that we had an example and that we would look towards the restoration in the last days with that understanding. We will do it under duress. Now the text here also says, behold his bed which is Solomon's. And the term does not say it is Solomon, but rather the litter is that which is Solomon's. This litter was the litter of the heritage of Solomon. Now there's something going on here in allegory. We appear to be speaking of the allegory of the kingship under Solomon and the extension of that power. Thus we appear to be speaking of the descendants of Solomon over the history of the church. If we're talking about Solomon and his litter, and it's quite clear that it's not Solomon in the litter. You know, though the valiant men somehow couldn't contain the woman from getting out of Jerusalem. Now the text was understood to refer to Solomon on the day of his espousals, according to Melvin. Isaiah Deuteronomy continues here with his explanation that the shepherd is astonished at her going alone into the wilderness, without fear of being attacked. Here we behold what King Solomon did for the love of a woman, as the Cencino says. The story might also be extended to embrace the power and the right of Messiah, who deals with the unified nation of Israel on his return. However, the shepherd is distinct from Solomon, and the time sequence indicates we are dealing with Judah in the sequence of the church. The time sequence here would have to be during Pergamos, following on from Smyrna, as we see in Revelation 2:9-17, if we're trying to fit that into an era concept. What I'm, if you to divorce from the era concept, we simply say when the church was ruled from Smyrna at the time of Polycarp and Polycrates, and then on into when the rulership transferred from that time on into Asia Minor, when the church was under the control of the Paulicians, through until the rise of Islam. Now Revelation 2:9-17 says, I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich, and I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. And to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things saith he which hath a sharp sword with two edges. I know thy works, and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is, and that thou holdest fast my name, and hast not denied my faith, even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you where Satan dwelleth. But I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication. So hast thou also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate. And repent, or else I will come unto thee quickly, and will fight against thee with them with the sword of my mouth. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit said unto the churches. To him that overcometh, I will give to eat of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, save he that receiveth it. Now, the persecution of the Smyrna era had been brought about by Roman authority, but it had been assisted by the divisions and the animosity caused by Judah. It's important to understand what's happening at Smyrna. Now, whether or not you accept eras, it's impossible to get away from an era concept in the first churches of Ephesus and Smyrna, because Smyrna succeeded to the authority of Ephesus. And it's a fact of history. So people say, oh, I don't believe in eras. You can't get away from the fact that the Ephesian and the Smyrna era were, in fact, two passages of authority, one or the other. One superseded the other, and Smyrna became the center to which the other churches looked. And we have records of Irenaeus writing letters back, informing Smyrna of what was happening in Lyons in southern France. So there's no question that Irenaeus looked to Polycarp, Polycrates, and the successors as the conceptual nucleus of the church and the disciples of John. So that it followed on from there, where their authority was not Roman. Irenaeus didn't recognize. He kept Smyrna informed. So you ended up with this concept where there was a passage, and then from Pergamus, you ended up with this movement in Asia Minor, which then succeeded in power the church in Smyrna. There's no question it's a progression of authority through Asia Minor. So whether you accept the era system in the last days, you can't get away from the era system in the first days. It's impossible. And if you try and throw it away, you can't understand what's happening in the centre of power. And the reason the Catholics attack it in the early days is because they want to claim that they were always the centre of the church. And they were not. But the understanding that Smyrna had an authority and a sequence, and that they were looked to for spiritual guidance as far west as France, is an anathema to the existing power of the Catholic Church. The Trinitarian systems, now I've produced a significant comment in there between the first and the second sentences of the paper. The Trinitarian systems in the West saw a reaction to their power in the East. The foundation of the Catholic system from the support of Theodosius as emperor in 381 AD saw the church persecuted. The Judaic kingdoms in Arabia and North Africa saw Islam rise as a reaction to both systems based on some but not all Christian doctrines. There are Christian doctrines in the Quran. You can't get away from that. Christ is mentioned significantly in the Quran, and he's referred to as the Messiah in the Quran. And the church was forced into an alliance with Islam because of the Roman Empire in Constantinople. The Jewish hegemony over Arabia was destroyed at the same time. Thus Judah was set in fear and dispersed. The 60 mighty men show that we're dealing with a reduced force. It was neither the spiritual power and authority of the 70 of the Sanhedrin, as that was removed to the church in Luke 10:1. Now the mighty men are afraid because the system being relied on physical force has no power to deal with either Western Trinitarianism or the Church and Islamite Unitarianism. The Paulicians during the Pergamus era put Constantinople's forces to flight and pillaged Asia Minor up to the Taurus Mountains and to the sea. Now they gained the protection of Islam throughout the empire. The Church in Islamite Spain also enjoyed the protection at this time. The paper on the general distribution of Sabbath-keeping churches gives you a feel for what's happening in the movement and power plays which led up to the rise in Islam. These stories, drawing out of the Song of Songs, this gradual, it's a prophecy. And when you understand the Song of Songs properly, it's not only the love story of the church, it's the story of the problems of the church. It's a story of things that are happening in Judah, and it's a story of how the church is taken out of Judah and how it's established in the nations. Christ said he would proceed against Pergamus with the sword of his mouth because they were tainted by the thinking that goes with military force, and Christ deals with them accordingly. The church, and also Judah, was from this time supported in the wilderness, symbolized by hidden manna. Now the hidden manna relates to the power of the Spirit, which was the prerogative of the church only. Judah was, however, still protected by God. But remember, the Holy Spirit is the total prerogative of the church. The nation of Judah does not possess the Holy Spirit, nor can. The white stones are they that form the foundation of the temple under Solomon. When you study the construction of the temple, you'll find that the whole of the foundations were built on white stones. And the whole structure of giving a white stone and a new name goes into the concept of franchise in the Hellenized world. You were given a stone with a name on it in the Hellenized world, and some of the cities of the Hellenized structure. And you put them, you gave your name. Giving a name, you placed a name in terms of voting in petitions. Like as we would put a card in a door, sort of slot in a door. Well, you're able to do that. You're given this voting franchise. When you're given this white stone, it represented two things. You, A, became one of the foundations of the temple. Secondly, you were given the power to vote, and that's not understood at all. So the white stone with the new name is evidence of the power to contribute by voice to the government of God as part of the administration which forms the foundation of the city of God. The crown referred to in chapter 3:11 is not held to be a symbol of royalty, but of happiness. Now this equated with the garlands worn on festive occasions. We refer to the Sansino for an explanation of that. The espousals referred to here concern Solomon and the crown given him by his mother, which was in fact not of Judah, as she was Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And hence we are speaking of a different system. The espousal may have been his wedding, or refer to the union with foreign gods with which she had become enmeshed. And that's my view. Solomon fell from grace. Solomon was an idolater. And this whole process of the Song of Songs is dealing with the idolatry of Solomon. And he got his idolatry from the foreign wives. A, his mother was a foreigner, and that set the rotting, and he had a predilection for foreign wives, and he had a predilection for foreign gods. And he established their system of worship in Jerusalem so he could be a truly universal monarch. He built temples for them to worship in Jerusalem. And he then commenced sacrificing, so he didn't favour one of his wives over the other. He sacrificed their temples. He built Pharaoh's daughter a shrine. He built all sorts of things in Jerusalem. And he shouldn't have done it. Now in chapter 4, verse 1, we go on here to a new concept. Some refer to this text as commencing a discourse of Solomon pressing his suit with the woman and extolling her beauty. Others hold that it is the shepherd who is addressing his beloved after the arrival of his retinue. This is considered more probable by Ibn Ezra, Isaiah the Charmian, and Melbourne. Where possible, I quote the concepts from the rabbinical authorities who deal with it, because I find them useful in demonstrating what I'm saying anyway. And it saves a lot of argument when they say, who said that? You say, oh, well, Ibn Ezra, Isaiah the Charmian, and Melbourne, those three are of the same opinion. You're dealing with the greatest rabbinical commentators of all time. They make very useful comments which show great insight into the meaning of specific words, the meaning of texts. Now the Song of Songs, chapter 4, verses 1 to 16, says, behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Dove's eyes within thy locks. And once you've got heavy eyebrows or something, you know, it's clumsy. It will address these concepts. The two says, thy teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn, which comes up from the washing, whereof every one bear twins, and none is barren among them. Thy lips are like a thread of scarlet, and thy speech is comely. Thy temples are like a piece of a pomegranate within thy locks. Thy neck is like the tower of David builded for an armory, whereupon there hang a thousand bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins, which feed among the lilies, until the day break and the shadows flee away. I will get me to the mountains of myrrh and to the hills of frankincense. Thou art fair, my love, there is no spot in thee. Now, you look at that and you say, that's odd way to describe a woman. It is an odd way to describe a woman, but it's not an odd way to describe a woman who is the Church of God. And we'll examine what they mean. The text here deals with the attributes of the beloved. The eyes as doves refer back to chapter 1 verse 15. I've already commented on that. Rashi says that the comparison is suggested by the innocence of the dove. Melbourne says that it is an old custom to sing praises of the bride at a wedding. And verse 1 is translated as thy eyes are as doves behind thy veil by the Sansina. So the translations differ because sometimes there's a word used only once in the Bible, or twice or three times in the Bible. And the Sansina uses specific words which don't occur anywhere else in the Bible, or only occur in concepts of Isaiah and Jeremiah. They're prophetic concepts, or specific words to deal with a specific concept. Very precise. Now the veil conceals the entire face save the eyes. This follows Ibn Granach and Kimchi. Rashi explains that the Hebrew denotes a hair net to keep her locks tidy, the root meaning is to confine, according to Sansina. The sense is one of constraint. Now the beloved is beautiful and sees in beauty regardless of the constraints upon her and the limitations of the disclosure of the mysteries of God. The comments regarding the hair being as a flock of goats refers to the natural glossy black colour of the goat of each braid when the sun shone upon it as hair glistened with a beautiful sheen, according to Darth Mikra from the Sansina. The text that trailed down from Mount Gilead is regarded as presenting difficulties, not surprisingly. It occurs only here, chapter 6, verse 5. Both ancient and modern commentators vary widely in the interpretation. The Sansina considers that the best interpretation is that proposed by Professor Yehuda, who connected it with an Arabic root which is to do a thing before dawn. The picture here is a flock of goats coming down from the mountainside in rows just before the daybreak, forming white lines against the dark background in the dim light. Now, these concepts deal with and lean towards people developing this concept of the place of safety in Gilead, where Petra, where you're coming down through. It's not in Gilead, you see. That's a problem when you're dealing with Petra. They misplace things. So you've got these concepts of these people coming down before the dawn, at the advent of the Messiah, and forming white lines against the dark background and the dim light. It holds that this interpretation seems to be alluded to in a midrashic comment on the phrase, that is, when a woman has a luxuriant growth of hair, she arranges it in white lines, that is, in plaits which show white partings in between. So the midrash tries to make sense of it. Thus they render it as, thy hair is like a flock of goats that trail down in the morning twilight. That then is an explanation of it. And the difficulty might be better understood or removed if the church were referred to in the entire arrangement of the white rose, whereas the elect in white garments being arrayed in the dawn of the Messianic system. When the day dawns in the hearts of the elect, as we understand from 2 Peter 1:19, and who partake of the divine nature from 2 Peter 1:4, and are called out of the darkness into his marvellous light from 1 Peter 2:9. Now the area of Gilead is that area east of the Jordan. The Sansina says that it is a chain of mountains beyond the Jordan, intersected by numerous valleys. The tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh found a home there, from Joshua 17:1 onwards. Gilead was renowned for its rich pasture and countless flocks, we see from Numbers 23:1 and Micah 7:14. It lies within the view of Jerusalem. The fact that it lies within the view of Jerusalem is also significant. We are relating the text to the anticipation of the Messianic advent and the end of the current age. Gilead was held in nexus to the kings of Judah, from Jeremiah 22:6. The kingship was removed because of their idolatry and given to those who became both kings and priests under God, from Revelation 5:10. Thus Gilead symbolized the place of peace for the elect. There was a balm in Gilead, yet the health of the people was not restored, as we see from Jeremiah 8:22, due to their idolatry, which we see from Jeremiah 8:19. The nations were also told to go up to Gilead to take balm, from Jeremiah 46:11. This is from the beginning of Jeremiah. Gilead's mentioned in Jeremiah at the beginning and at the end. And you're dealing with this concept of dealing with Judah and then the nations, and that Gilead plays a central position in this. And that's not accidental. The salvation was from this prophecy over the extent of the entire book of Jeremiah, removed from Judah and extended to the Gentiles. There must be no iniquity in Gilead, according to Hosea 12:11, and the destruction of the women of Gilead will be punished, according to Amos 1:13. This is the basis of the parable of the sheep and the goats on Matthew 25:31 following. It's a punishment because of the way of dealing with the women of Gilead. The Messianic restoration will involve Benjamin taking Gilead, as we see from Obadiah 19. Thus the inheritance of Reuben and Gad with half of Manasseh is elsewhere beyond the Jordan to the east. You can't give the inheritance of these three tribes to another tribe without relocating them in their inheritance. And their inheritance is outside of Israel. It was beyond the Jordan to the east. Now what we've seen is that Benjamin expands and takes over Gilead, in the end days, and that's given. It's given to Benjamin. So the inheritance of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh must be elsewhere. And you can only understand that by interrelating these texts one to the other. Michael says that the people who are the flock of the inheritance of Messiah will dwell alone in a forest in the midst of a garden land. And they will feed Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. From Micah 7:14. This period refers to the period after the destruction of the plant by the nations, from Micah 7:8-17. Micah 7:8-17. Then the restoration of the last days shall be as the Exodus, and it will be to Gilead and the Lebanon also, from Zechariah 10:10. Thus the elect shall also come from Lebanon, as we see from verse 8. The teeth are compared here to the whiteness of newly washed wool, the colour of snow, from Isaiah 1:18. Now the student of the New Testament here will immediately recognise a symbolism of spiritual cleanness from Revelation 15:6, 19:8, and 14, and the washing of the robes of the elect in the blood of the Lamb from Revelation 3:5 and 18, 4:4, 6:11, 7:9, 13 and 14. The fact that they are all shaped alike, from the Sansina, Rashi explains as well numbered, and Kimchi and Ibn Ezra explain as all of the same size. The significance is to the fact of the enumeration of the Book of Life of the Lamb, and they all spiritually prepared alike. The text whereof all are paired, according to Daf Mikra explains that they are like sheep, each of which keeps to its mate, that is here symbolized by the upper and lower teeth. Rashi connects a word for paired with mathom, or perfection, that is none were decayed. Now this is considered to be the correct interpretation. Do you remember also that none was barren? Also. I mean, teeth don't bear anything. Only by Rashi's identification of the Hebrew can we see the state of spiritual perfection among the elect being the subject. The Sansina renders the text whereof all are paired and none faileth among them. The text is interpreted as being a play on words. All of them, shukulam, are paired and none is missing, shakula, among them. So it's like a poem. The real point is that they are paired, they are perfect, they are clothed in white, they do have spiritual perfection, and none is missing. That is, those who are called by God are kept intact and brought into the system and without spot and blemish. Now, thy lips are like a thread of scarlet. So this text refers to the salvation of the Gentiles through the Passover sacrifices prefigured by the salvation of Rahab at the wall of Jericho. Now, you see the fall of Jericho for explanation of that. The thread of scarlet was tied on the windows of Rahab to bring the Gentiles into salvation. And these scarlet threads took part in the temple sacrifices at Passover. And the Hebrew word here for the mouth is midbarek, or thy speech, or the instrument of thy speech, namely the mouth. But sort of David says that her lips, being red and thin, are comparable to a thread of red scarlet. Now, thin red lips are hardly sensual. Well, you don't normally say, I love your thin red lips, you know. I mean, that's not the mark of beauty in a sensual mouth. So the sense must be concerned with the text elsewhere in the Bible, and the sense of the speech being perfect is also correct when we see that that condition is the one of the creation and extended to Satan before the fall, where his instruments were perfect before iniquity was found in him. And we look at that from Ezekiel 28:13-14. Let's look at Ezekiel 28:13-14 in the companion Bibles, it'll be easier. Ezekiel 28:13-14 says, thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle with gold. The workmanship of thy tablets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou wast created. And it was perfect in thee. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth, and I have set thee so that thou wast upon the holy mountain of God, thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created. The pipes and tabrets were the instruments of speech and music. the reference to that is to the morning stars singing together at the foundation of the earth, as we see in Job 38, verse 4 to 7. Satan was found perfect until iniquity was found in him, and we are expected to be perfect. Now the next concept is that the temples being like a pomegranate split open behind the veil refers to the complexion being ruddy. Now going through the explanation of the rabbinical schools as we go through, and then I'll give you what I consider to be the taking their concepts, what the correct concept is, using the New Testament to interpret the Old. Now the word for temple refers to the thin part of the skull, and Ibn Ezra translates pilak as the red flower of the pomegranate. Accordingly, he praises her ruddy complexion. Those who translate the text as a pomegranate split open explain that the temples gleam through the veil as the mingled white and red of the pomegranate gleam through the cracks in the rind. That's Masudah David specifically says that. Rashi renders the text like half a pomegranate. He is praising her for the roundness of her cheeks and their ruddy colour. The reference is to the elect. The splitting open perhaps refers to the curtain, because we're talking about being behind the veil. And you can't get in the King James text and the RSV, you sometimes don't get the translations that you get from the rabbinical schools, and the rabbinical translations in the Sonsina. Now the elect went behind the veil when it was torn in two by the sacrifice of Messiah, symbolized by the ruddy colour. The play on words places the elect as the inner sanctuary. The reference to the neck and the Tower of David built with turrets, whereupon hang 1,000 shields, is a reference to the numbers of the inner administration of the celestial government. You say, wow, that's a long bow, mate. It's not a long bow at all. The sacrifice of Messiah was determined from among the 1,000 of the angelic host. This inner number of the host appears to relate to the Elohim central structure, and the sacrifice of one of them was determined from the beginning. This was also understood from Job 33, verses 19 to 24. I want you to turn to Job 33, verses 19 to 24, while reading. Now, Matsudah David merely says that 1,000 represents a large number. And we'll see that why that's not correct. The shields were used as ornaments, according to the Sonsina, comparing that with Ezekiel 27:11. The fact of the matter is that anciently the fortified structure was as strong as its defenders. The practice of displaying shields during heraldic times were a sign to those without of who the defenders were, and they signified the composition, derivation, and loyalties of the defenders. What was happening is that when you put your shield up on the battlements, it not only told you, it told anyone observing a number of things. It told you roughly the size of the defence. It was done generally to show the allegiance of the town and its surrounds. In the heraldic time, the shields had emblazons. And most shields were emblazoned with something, and you could generally tell who a person's shield was, long before they were actually codified into heraldic arms. The armorial bearings of the family, now I'll give you an example. Because they're codified amongst our people, and every family, every person who carries his name under English law, Anglo-Saxon law, is entitled to the arms of his family. And my family's coat of arms was issued in 1295. It's a gold shield with three blue bars across the shield, and then up in the corner, the top left-hand corner as you look at the shield, is a red square. In that red square is the head of a white line. Now, it's a fairly simple shield because our family was awarded the shield many centuries ago, and it's one of the most ancient of our people. You can tell a lot from names and organisations. Our name, for instance, is a contraction of the word Isaac, and it means the son of Jacob. We were held by the Heraldic Society to be direct descendants of Israel. And that name is the commonest name, or the central name of the Anglo-Saxon peoples. You can tell also a white lion, a lion's head on a red background. You can tell that normally the white line was associated with the descendants of William the Conqueror through John of Gaunt, namely the Mortimers and the Kings. So you would say somewhere our family became associated or by intermarriage with the family of the Conqueror sometime before 1295, which was fairly early. Now, you tell lots of things from feudals, and you tell lots of things from... Now, the family established, our family prince is established in England and Ireland. And the only way you can tell the difference between the Irish Coxes and the English Coxes is the motto, which is born in the arms beneath the shield. But you can't tell that from looking at a castle. Well, the Irish motto is faith and fortitude, and the motto of the English family is I pray for no more. Now, all of those things you can tell from looking at a shield if you understand the shields. Like my great-grandmother was from the tribe of Gahagan in Ireland. You know, their family is a white shield with a red line rampant, similar to the line of Scotland, with three red hands in each of the corners of the shield, meaning that they were associated with the Ulster families and that they were part of that Milesian system. So you can tell allegiances from simple things like that. Now, these concepts refer to each one of those being an individual. And you then produce a concept of a necklace around the neck, means they all fit together to form one composite structure. And that's the real meaning. The elect are part of the armies of God in a defensive structure. And you can't pick that out of your... If you're thinking about this as a voluptuous woman with a necklace around her neck, then you don't really understand what is being meant, because we'll get down to the concept. Well, one of these beads is perfect. You see, one of these beads of the necklace is perfect. And that bead becomes the shield. So it's the shield they're talking about in the first place, which symbolises the warriors who make up the armies of God. And each one of those is perfect. In the same way, each of the teeth was perfect. So we're dealing with the perfection of the saints and their functions. Let's look at Job chapter 33, verse 19. Now, it's a very important text. We're talking about, through this process, you've got the three friends of Job, and then Elihu, commences to speak. And we're then talking about the factors of God Almighty. And I think, read chapters 32 and 33 when you go home and Bible study. In fact, the whole book of Job requires a Bible study to be written on it. The whole book of Job is important. It's another minor task to do than the check. It says in verse 19, he is chastened also with pain upon his bed, and the multitude of his bones with strong pain. Now, he's talking about man generally here. Perhaps if we go back to 14, it says here, for God speaketh once, yea twice, yet man perceives it not, in a dream and a vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men, and slumberings upon the dead. Then he openeth the ears of men, and sealeth their instruction. In other words, God appears to them through the Spirit, and gives them instruction. He opens their ears. And that's the fact. Man can't hear with hearing unless God opens your ears. That he may withdraw man from his purpose and his pride from man. He keepeth back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. So it's God that keeps you whole and keeps you from perishing. And 19 it says, he is chastened also with pain upon his bed and the multitude of his bones with strong pain. So that his life abhorreth bread and his soul dainty meat. How did you get to the point where you don't want to eat? His flesh is consumed away, that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. Yea, his soul draweth near unto the grave, and his life to the destroyers. It says, if there be a messenger with him, an interpreter, now listen to this, and this is, the word here is mediator, not interpreter. If there be a messenger with him, a mediator, one among a thousand to show unto a man his uprightness, and the messenger here is one of the angelic hosts, then he is gracious unto him and says, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. His flesh shall be fresher than a child's, and he shall return to the days of his youth. In the RSV, it says in verses 23 to 24, if there be for him an angel, a mediator, one of the thousand, to declare to man what is right for him, and is gracious to him, to deliver him from going into the pit, I have found a ransom. Now the King James Version utterly distorts that text. And the reason the King James Version utterly distorts and obscures that text is so that you can't understand that it was an angel who was the mediator between God and man, because Jesus Christ was that angel. And the Trinitarians deliberately mistranslated the text in the King James so you couldn't understand it. And that mediator was one of the thousand. So the thousand relate to that structure of the angelic host which comprises, and one day I'll write the whole sequence within the 144,000 of what the structure is. But you're looking at, you've got the 3, then the 30, then the rest of the 70 plus 2, which makes up the inner and outer council. Then you've got the administrative structure. You find that Christ then started ordaining other people. You have the 300 and the 500. And you've got the 120, sorry, then the 300 and the 500. And you've got the whole structure adding up to an administrative structure within the 1,000. Now those numbers continue and expand through to 144,000. There's nothing accidental about the concept, the thousands, used in the Song of Songs, because the thousand specifically refers to the inner angelic host from which one of was taken in order to atone for the sins of mankind and to prevent man from going to the pit. And the Bible is quite clear on it, and you cannot understand it from the King James Version. You have to look at other versions, because the King James Version has been deliberately mistranslated and distorted. Peculiarly, to stop the concept of the mediation for man being an angel. But the RSV and other texts have to correct it, because it is incorrect. Now, even Ezra renders the text, "They're builded as with turrets, as meaning for the suspension of arms. The mound or tell in which arms are stored, that is, the neck is compared to the mound, not to the swords." Now Rashi and Rashbam translate talpioth as if delivered from the root to teach, as aleph, the first letter being elided. The rendering of the targum, that's the tractate targum, the instruction of the law, may have suggested this explanation according to the Sonsina. Now the neck of the Shulamite is like a splendid tower built as a model for others to follow. The word is understood by the Septuagint as a proper noun. Now the Tower of David built towards Talpioth. That's the way the Septuagint gets around this difficulty. So it just treats Talpioth as a place so that the turret was built looking towards Talpioth. This context seems to evade the issue or complex problem presented by the text. The fact of the elect being those beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and those who would not worship the beast, in fact its number from the New Testament, as we see in Revelation 20 verse 4, could not, of course, be addressed here by the Sonsina. The Sonsina hasn't got the New Testament with which to interpret the Old. And only when Judah gets the New Testament can it then interpret what is meant in the Old. You need the New Testament to understand properly the Old, and the Old Testament to understand properly the New. That is why Christianity and Judaism are mutually agreed on splitting the two, one from the other. That is, when I say Christianity, I mean Catholicism, modern mainstream Christianity, and Judaism are both agreed on divorcing the two books completely, because then neither can understand the Bible, and they are happy in their ignorance. Now, the reference to the breasts being two fawns that feed among the lilies has stumped the Hebrew commentators, who are trying to work out, now, what does it mean? And so that David holds that fawns appear more beautiful when they feed among lilies. The reference is to the feeding of the flock and the clothing of the lilies of the field as greater than Solomon in all his glory. Remember, the flock is fed on both milk and meat. We'll see how Christ is in fact the bread, the living bread from heaven, and that out of him living waters flow. Now, the concept of the lilies of the field being greater than Solomon in all his glory is directly an interpretation of Christ at Matthew 6, verses 24 to 34, and you can just read that when you're at home. The concept, quite clearly, is that Christ pulls these concepts out. Now, he doesn't just sort of pull them out of the air. Everything Christ says is related back to Scripture. And it's the whole concept of feeding the flock is developed also from that, and being clothed as the lilies is as better or greater than Solomon. Because remember here, the Beloved rejects Solomon and Solomon's system for her Beloved. That is, the Shulamite rejects Solomon and goes for after the Messiah. Now, the concept here of the day breathing, as we understand in the text, is the same as at chapter 2, verse 17. The cooling or breathing of the day symbolizes the joy of the Beloved at meeting the Shepherd at the end of the day. This refers to the Messianic Advent. The start of the day for the elect is also the first love when the day dawns in the heart of the elect, as we see above. And also, as we see from Revelation, the Ephesian era. The Tzitzit of David renders the text, "When evening comes, I shall repair to the open country, where everything is sweet and fragrant, like myrrh and frankincense." The translation of the Song of Songs is rendered in different ways to make sense of these words by the rabbinical authorities. And that's why the King James Version and the RSV need to be read with the rabbinical commentaries to show you, because there are words that are translated are only used here. And you need to look at the words, and that's why this commentary, I've written this commentary, so that we can look at the words involved and the concepts involved and see just what complexity there is in the Song of Songs. That's why it hasn't been understood readily. That's why people look at that and go, "Oh, what does it mean?" Because it's very difficult to understand. Because it's a deeply spiritual symbolism. And the cooling or breathing of the day symbolizes the joy of the Beloved at meeting the Shepherd at the end of the day, as I said. It refers to the Messianic Advent. The symbolism of myrrh and frankincense, and especially myrrh, has been dealt with in the commentary on Esther, and it's also above. The nexus with Messiah is unmistakable. Indeed, those were the specific offerings at his birth by the Magi, as we see from Matthew 2:11. The Magi didn't wake up one morning and say, "Well, what are we taking on? We'll take in frankincense and myrrh." They brought gold, frankincense and myrrh to Messiah because they were ordered by the Holy Spirit to take gold, frankincense and myrrh. They couldn't have brought anything else. In the same way, many of the things that happen to us are ordered by the Holy Spirit, and the things that you cannot do. Now it says here, "Then thou art fair, my love, and there is no spot in thee." Remember, the text ends with that particular verse, ends with that. This is a direct reference to the elect being without spot or blemish, as we see from the primary concept of the Lamb that was Messiah, from 1 Peter 1:19, where the Lamb was without spot and blemish, and also the elect at 2 Peter 3:14 are without spot and blemish. Read Peter's comments around those texts also. So that's what they're talking about. Love is without spot, and that is the concept. It's Messiah and the church that are both without spot and blemish. Now, this is a salutation of Messiah to the bride who are the elect. The next phase is his call to the church.